partisans, ouvriers et paysans, c'est l'alarme. Ce soir, l'ennemi connaîtra le prix du sang et des larmes. Montez de l'abîme, descendez des collines, camarades. Sortez de la paille, les fusils, la mitraille, les grenades.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and appropriate for the conversation we're about to have, you're listening to Josephine Baker under us, Paris Mère Amour, this global superstar, incredible woman, native of the United States, this African-American woman going to France. She was recruited by French military intelligence as the honorable correspondent and spied for them and worked with them and collecting information on German troops and locations. And her celebrity status allowed her to travel through Europe so she could spy for the French against the Germans. And she got a Croix de Guerre for this. So we thought we'd open this conversation with that. And why? I'll tell you why. Because we're about to talk to Rob Gardner, who's producer of this new documentary that is going to appear on PBS tomorrow night, called Enemy of the Reich, the Nur Inyat Khan Story. We're also joined by Alex Cronemer, who is executive producer of Enemy of the Reich, the Nur Inyat Khan Story. And Rob and Alex, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Alex,
thank you.
Welcome, Alex. So 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can log on to our Facebook pages, hit us at talk at steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. We want to hear about your thoughts about this. I was going to start with a clip, but let me just start with you, if I might first, Rob, to talk a bit about who this woman was and what drew you to the story. And
Alex Cronemer really brought me this story. In fact, Alex may want to talk about the development of the story originally, because he was really the central figure.
Alex, why don't you start us off then?
Sure. 2 years ago, or maybe 2 or 3 years ago now, I was doing a screening for one of our earlier films that I made with Rob. And at the screening, this person came up to me to tell me this amazing story about a relative of theirs, a Jewish person who had been living in Paris when the Nazis invaded and had been rescued by a Muslim family and survived the war because of this family's sheltering person. And it was kind of was an amazing story, and it got me wondering about other stories that might be like that. I'd never heard ever anything regarding Muslims in World War II in any, certainly in any heroic way, and not in Paris. And then after we started doing some research, we found that there were really many stories about Muslims fighting heroically in Paris during the Nazi years. There was the Paris Mosque that sheltered Jews. There was the Muslim Franco Hospital that hid, shot down U.S. and British airmen and received an award from President Eisenhower after the war. And there was, of course, the Algerian immigrants, many of whom fought in the French resistance and died opposing the Nazis. And then we found the story of this woman. So we really wanted to bring one of these stories to light, and her story was really, in many ways, the more compelling one and the more unusual one, given that she was a woman and really an unlikely hero. So that was the story that I had sat down for a lunch with Rob at the Petit Louis up in Baltimore, and we started talking about this, and Rob, you can take it from there.
Well, it's a great story, and initially there was a mystery in this story, which is how did this young woman, who's a very gentle, very sweet young woman, who read children's story on the French radio, wrote children's stories, she was a musician, she was a student of child psychology, very sweet and gentle person, in a very short amount of time becomes this extremely effective agent for the British, dodging the Gestapo in Paris under extremely difficult and dangerous circumstances. How did she make this transition? And what we found in looking at her background was that she grew up in a home that was a Sufi spiritual center in Paris at a time between the wars when European intellectuals were drawn, because of all the deaths in World War I, were drawn to this place of learning and peace. And her father was an extremely important Sufi mystic. He's been compared to the Dalai Lama in his spiritual presence, let's say. And this is the environment in which she grew up. So it turned out that the values that she had, the central values, had to do with the recognition of the commonwealth of humanity, of the rights of people to be free. And she not only believed in this kind of at an intellectual level, she was deeply invested in it in a spiritual level. And it was from this that this extraordinary courage came.
The story was interesting to me. I mean, I had been aware of some of the Muslim stories that took place during World War II, but not of this one, nor of the this interesting story about who she was as a deeply spiritual human being and the daughter of this incredible mystic. I was just blown away by that part, and your descriptions of Sufism, but the power. Go ahead. You want to say what?
No.
But I'm really exploring the power of this young woman. I mean,
right.
I mean, what she had inside of her that allowed her to face down this enemy even after capture.
I agree with you, and this is the. I think this is why her story particularly grabbed my imagination initially, which was, you know, is that where do the wellsprings of courage come from in anybody? And particularly those that lead people on to doing very heroic things. I know, and I'm being quite honest with you, when I was first reading the things she went through, and then encountering the part of the story where she was told by her handlers in the UK, come back, you know, come back home, get out of there, it's not safe. Yet she decided to stay and remain behind because she didn't want all the efforts and all the sacrifices up to that point to be lost. I have to say, I think I would have probably gotten on that plane and gone back home. She didn't.
Many of us would have.
Yeah, and that's. I mean, I think that's why we admire heroes, because you know, they are in many ways models for us, and they show us the courage that is really, really within everybody, and particularly, you know, some of the other stories we looked at. You know, for example, the Algerian French resistance fighters. You know, they're very. It's a very good story, very important story, and I hope someone tells that story. But you know, it's a macho story, right? It's, you know, guys in arms and right. bands of brothers, that kind of thing. But here's the story of the quintessential hero. I mean, somebody had no business doing what she was doing, and really was not. You know, I mean, she weighed barely more than 100 pounds, and as Rob said, you know, she was kind of gentle. She played an instrument. She had grown up in this Sufi spiritual center, you know, and yet. She was able to find within herself the determination, the courage, and as the document and as the story says, when their network was penetrated by a double agent, and most of them were arrested. You know, there were a lot of men who were arrested, and many of them, and of course under brutal interrogation, but nevertheless, many of them did give information to the Nazis, whereas she never did. She refused to even tell them what her real name was. So it's an amazing story of heroism, and it's very inspiring.
And I think you can't underestimate how dangerous this was, that they were constantly seeking radio trucks looking for these people, and the Nazis played hardball. We know they did. And they were more competent than the British counterparts were. This woman was on her own in the starkest way, and her courage emerged from that.
I'm going to play some clips from this to get a feel for it. Let's start with that clip about that you suggested that Mark Henry has lined up, which is the clip where she meets the man who finally says, "Yes, she should be one of our spies."
And trained in the bomber command, in many ways, she was an ideal candidate for the SOE's French network.
She was plunged into this world where everything that she thought about or did related to the mission that she was being prepared for.
Surviving War Office documents describe Noor as emotional and imaginative. Her superiors remarked on her selfless dedication.
The motive for her accepting the present task is apparently idealism. She was longing to do something more active in the prosecution of the war. Something which would make more call on her capabilities and perhaps demand more sacrifice.
There was something that seemed almost unworldly about her, which struck them as exotic. And given her name and her background, this I'm sure this played into a sort of sense of her.
Noor's instructors saw this uncommon idealism as a distraction.
So I just want to play a little piece that we have another couple of clips coming up. But one of the things I want to digress for a moment, and Rob, is I think is your style and approach to documentary filmmaking. Everybody has a different way of kind of approaching a story, right? Mm. And you, and I've seen some of your other films. I think it's been too many years, almost been 12 years or 10 years since I've seen you last in this program, which is much too long. I'm glad you're in the studio with us now. But that you take elements of traditional documentary footage, taking things from the past with great narration, but then you add in dramatic sequences with actors.
So this is a technique which is very expensive, and I tip.
I was going to say that with
Alex.
Yeah.
You know, Alex is very clear that he wanted, and he always is on our productions. He wanted this to be very good, and initially. We're going to shoot this in Europe because a lot of this kind of large-scale production we've done in Eastern Europe because it's cheap. But certain Baltimore production people, one of whom was the director of photography, who's my son, really leaned on us to try to do this in Baltimore because a lot of production work is done here in Baltimore.
Right.
The people are very good. But you know, we needed locations that would sell as European locations. So we did the numbers, and in Europe we would have had 60 people on the unit. In Baltimore, we had 35, but they all spoke English, which is a big plus. And Monday was not hangover day, as it is in Eastern Europe. And there's a level of just American work ethic that really kind of picked up the difference. The locations here were great, and the City of Baltimore Film Office was fantastic with us. And fortunately, because we shot also exteriors in Europe, if you saw the outside of the real place in Europe and then cut to the interior in Baltimore— It usually worked very well.
So you did shoot some in Europe.
Yeah, we shot exteriors in Europe. We went to the real places where these things happened for the most part. So you get very much of an exterior sense of place. And then we shot big exteriors with actors here in Baltimore on the Mount Vernon neighborhood.
It was Mount Vernon. Yeah. It was the train scene where the Nazi was shot and the explosion took place and they had this. Yeah. The Nazi soldier was blown backwards. Was that shot here in Baltimore?
That was, only we're not allowed to say where it was shot because the contract...
You can't
stipulates you can't represent the destruction of property. I think it's a Smithsonian rule or something. It's a great look, a fabulous location, and they were very good to us. And
that's funny.
It was a very elaborate. It was a wire stunt. You know,
I saw that he was wired and pulled backwards. So.
Right. There were a lot of just great locations here. The Silbern Mansion at the Arboretum was great.
You did that. The interiors were shot there.
Yeah, the Gestapo headquarters and the British headquarters were there. Used my house in Roland Park for, I think, four locations, including her house in Paris. And we saw the real house in Paris, and they actually look kind of similar. Our biggest location was the Mennonite Church in Roland Park, the North Baltimore Mennonite Church on Roland Avenue, in which we built a very large set, which was the radio room, in which there were 12 radio operators.
Oh, yeah.
And this had to be the physical representation of the other side of the radio conversation that this radio operator was having. She all by herself would be in secret locations in Paris, but we had to see the British end of it. And we also needed a room that was big enough for people to move through and have conversations and to have some dynamics so that everyone wouldn't be sitting in offices. At that church, we also built the interior of the Dachau cell and the Gestapo cell and the interior of the airplane that we see her flying.
Okay, that's really interesting. I mean, it's a deep Baltimore connection. Well, you're from Baltimore, but let me play this other clip. This clip is her reading from the book to her younger siblings, the book that she wrote.
Mm-hmm. Great son had a little daughter with sunray hair and sky blue eyes, and great son loved her dearly, for when she played around the clouds, the whole sky would ring with sweet laughter.
Noor loved to share her stories with the children who visited the family home. She published a collection of fables called 20 Jataka Tales just months before she and her family were forced to abandon the house and flee.
So this particular scene and this whole idea that she wrote this children's book and that there's a conversation in there with her nephew, I think it is, who's a leader of the Sufi International, who talks about the power. He had these pages handwritten by her.
Yes. Yes, he said it was a picture of her very soul. And one of the things that we see in this scene of her before the war reading to the children is the sweetness of this character. She was, as a person, very charismatic. People liked her. Even the Germans liked her. She was not executed as immediately as most people would have been, having escaped from the Gestapo twice. She was not. She was sent to the concentration camp, maybe a small reward, but they liked her. It's clear from the post-war interrogation of the Germans that they liked her. She had an appeal for people. Twice when she was captured on the street or stopped by soldiers in the street, she was able to talk her way out of it because she had this charm.
And Alex, it sounds like in some ways this character speaks volumes for you about who we can be, but also that you sound like you fell in love with her a little bit.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things, I was actually reflecting on it this weekend. When you make a documentary film about a particular individual, and this particular one is the third or fourth we've made about a particular person, you know, you actually become quite intimate with them.
Right.
You read not only stuff that people have written about them, but you read a lot of their own personal writings. You have to get into their mind in a certain way because you're trying to tell a story in film, and so you have to know intimately a lot of details because, as Rob would tell you, that you know, filmmaking is the art of what to leave out. You know, there's only so much you can cover effectively in an hour and have it follow a dramatic arc. So there's a lot of stuff you end up leaving out, but you have to know it all very, very deeply. And at some point, and I've felt this way now with everyone that we've made, it's been about a person, you begin to feel a certain amount of fear too, because you really want to do this person's life justice. You know, you're the one making the film. You're the one that said, we're going to do this. And now we want to make sure we do it right. And so, yes, I do think that I think it would be fair to say that I think everybody fell in love with her quite a bit. And seeing her life dramatically reenacted as we were shooting scenes. I know that one of the last scenes, I think it actually was the last scene we shot, Rob, was the execution scene and we shot it at midnight, you know, and it was very... The mood on the set that particular evening was, I felt, quite different, because we were shooting the end of what happened in her life, and I felt a real wrenching emotion that evening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now that the film is going to have its, you know, airing nationally on PBS on Tuesday, and I think MPT is going to be airing it Wednesday. Now that all this is coming to an end, and we've been screening this film all across the country. We just had a screening, for example, this past weekend in Louisville, in a synagogue. And if you could have pictured a scene of 300 people packed on pews, women with hijab, men with yarmulkes, ministers with their collars, packed together to see this person's story, I'm going to miss it. You know, when the show finally airs and you know, we're on to something else, it's going to feel a little bit like. Like you're saying, leaving a love behind.
She's a haunting character. She's a haunting person. She was haunting to me throughout the process. And one of the things that happened that was quite extraordinary was that one of the nephews that appears in the film, who's an American, was living in Germany, and we had to go on a research trip to Dachau because we had to create Dachau and we had to know what the real place looked like, where she was executed. And we knew that he was in Germany, not close, but there. And we were trying to decide whether to go and meet him. Now, I had seen him in a BBC documentary about Noor, and I didn't care for him that much. And it was a long trip, and I was feeling sorry for myself, and I thought, But we finally decided to go ahead and make the trip and go see him. Well, it turns out, and he was a great guy, and it turns out that he had in his attic all of the family pictures, all of the documents, wow, her original stories, poems to her mother, the note from her teacher when she was 4 years old about her behavior, all the military documents that were given to them. I mean, notes from the British government telling the mother that the daughter was doing fine after she had been executed. I mean, it was tremendously intimate and powerful material, a lot of which we used in the film. And all of that... It was a kind of a picture of her soul, as her other nephew said. It was really quite extraordinary. She was a haunting person.
How did you get Helen Mirren to do the narration? It seemed like a coup to me to have.
Well, I think we had in our minds the narrating voice. We wanted it to be a woman, and you know, somebody with a bit of an English accent. And she was the absolute first person that came to mind. And honestly, it's really not that hard. You know, we just reached out to the agent, and the agent said he would check and see if she was interested. And it turned out that she had just finished a book. I don't know, remember now, Rob, whether it was actually a book about Nora Nikon or it was a book about World War II spies, but she had just finished reading. She's a very intelligent woman.
Yes.
Here, and she had just finished reading a book, and she was, the agent kind of called me back very shortly, you know, very, very suddenly excited to do the show, and he was a little standoffish in that first call, but his attitude changed quite a bit. He was very excited to do it because she was excited to do it. And she was excellent to work with. I mean, I think, something that a trained actress, you know, we've had trained actors before, and we've sometimes just had, you know, voices. But there's something the trained actor brings because they bring their own kind of interpretation to the narration. They bring their own brilliant talent. And she really did. I really felt like she added so much to the show by her narration. And she even, there were a couple of times where she suggested edits that we took because they were actually, they actually were smart.
Interesting.
So, you know, I had to, you know, I had to buck up Rob here a little bit because up until that moment, all the rough cuts had been Rob's narration, his scratch narration. You know, and after Helen was done, I said, you know, she was almost as good as you were.
almost.
I'll tell you a funny thing that happened with her regarding the young woman that played the character of Noor, who incidentally is a student now at the Peabody here in Baltimore.
Huh.
When we cast this young woman, Grace Servassian, I think she has a difficult to pronounce last name. We had a casting session here at Pat Moran's casting agency here in Baltimore. He's a very well-known casting agent, does The Wire and The Veep and whatnot, House of Cards. Grace came in, a group of women came in to audition, and everyone was all glammed up in makeup and, you know, except this young woman, Grace, who had no makeup and was quite sort of blasé about the whole thing. And we shot the tapes of the audition, and we took them back to my office, and we were looking at them. And my eye passed over Grace, and I went to a more conventional-looking woman, looked like a television actress to me. And the director of photography, is also my son, said to me, no, this one is the one, this Grace is the one. And we checked her out. She was. You know, I was wrong. And I told this story to Helen Mirren, who looked at the show, of course. And Helen Mirren really took me to task for not seeing the beauty and the power of this young actress in the first play. Of course, she was right. So Mirren took a real interest in the she really put herself into the narration, which a lot of celebrities do not do with, I must say, with documentaries. But she really did. She was great.
But it's a fantastic film. One more question here before we have to run. How long did it take you to make this film?
A little more than a year.
A little more than a year to make the film.
Yeah,
that's usually common with your docs.
Yeah, I would say
A year apiece. And you do a lot. I mean, I noticed that, and especially teaming up with Alex, you do a lot of films that kind of really cross cultural boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big thing for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm fortunate in that way. And one of the reasons it's great to work with Alex is that he has a strong mission in that regard, and so it's great. We also did a film about Catholic nuns last year, which was fascinating—a story about these women. And so these stories about cultures and people and faiths crossing are, I think they're not only fascinating, they're quite important.
Well, I want to thank you both. First, Rob Gardner, producer-director for The Enemy of the Reich, the Noor Inayat Khan story, incredible film, and I really encourage folks to watch this on PBS, and Alex Kronemeyer, who is the executive producer of the film Enemy of the Reich. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
For producing
thank
this
you.
Film. No, thank you very much. And it'll start tomorrow night on most PBS stations, Tuesday, September the 9th. You can go to enemyoftheReich.org or pbs.org for more information and find out when it will be in your locale, no matter where you're listening to this from. Who knows where you'll be if you're in California or something different, but go there and check it out. So thank you both so much for being here. It's been great.
Thank you.
And we'll have all those links on our website as well. I want to remind you, on our way out of here, the Mark Steiner Show, not out of here for our next segment, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. And we have to take a break here. We want you to stay with us. When we come back, I walk through Gallery CA in Baltimore with painter and muralist Stephen Towns to discuss his exhibit, Co-Patriot, currently on display there. His work was inspired by Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, Solomon Northup's 12 Years a Slave, and Harriet Ann Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. Incredible exhibit. Incredibly interesting man who was on our show just the other week. And we're going to break with It's Nasty by Grandmaster Flash and The Furious Five. On this day, Cowboy of Grandmaster Flash and The Furious Five died in 1989 from complications of AIDS. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
We sheets of relief contain the wild beast.